Today is Monday, October 10th, 2011. I'm Nina Kurigia.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan, and this is News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. To all your residents at the UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to all of you on the internet.
Good evening. It is 5 o'clock p.m. and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from Vancouver, federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Also today, we will be interviewing John Hayes right here in our studio. Hayes is a member of the Occupy Vancouver demonstration set to take place in downtown Vancouver on October 15th. And since we are very interested in the Occupy movement slowly spreading across the world, I'd like to have a well-informed discussion about the ideas fueling the frustrated minds behind this movement.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news. But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. Dozens of women in Yemen were injured yesterday during a celebration for the first Arab woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize. According to an organizer of the event, they were attacked by regime thugs with empty bottles and stones. Tawakkul Karman won the award for her work organizing months of peaceful pro-democracy protests calling for an end to 3 decades of rule by President Ali Abdullah Saleh. The Hamas-led government in Gaza now says foreigners will need an entry visa to travel to the region. The order comes on the heels of recent controversy between Hamas and some local NGOs. Rami Almagari has more.
Hamas says most foreigners will now have to get an entry visa to enter the territory. Applications for one-month visas will be taken online and must be done at least a week in advance of travel. The requirements will apply to foreign aid workers and activists. The new entry rules were posted last night and go into effect tomorrow. New entry rules for journalists are yet to be announced. Hamas contends that these measures are meant to ensure the safety of foreigners in Gaza. However, in recent months, the relationship between Hamas and local charities with ties to the US and Europe has soured. Authorities have demanded that the organizations provide details about their work. The US and Europe consider Hamas a terrorist organization, and as such bar any exchange of money with them, paying visa processing fees to the government would violate the ban. Rami Almirari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
Indonesian police killed at least one striking miner at the Freeport mine in Papua. 10 others were wounded. Clashes broke out when the U.S. mining giant sent replacement workers to cross the picket line. The strike is in its 4th week. Thousands of workers are calling for a pay hike to bring them up to international standards. California's governor finally signed a bill that increases farm workers' union rights. The measure will punish employers for breaking union election rules and speed up mediation. The bill does not, however, mandate majority sign-up, known as a card check. Governor Jerry Brown also signed a ban on the open carrying of handguns. And the second part of the state's version of a DREAM Act is now law, allowing undocumented students to receive financial aid for public colleges. Brown did veto a measure. It would have let California universities consider race and gender for admissions purposes. A meeting of youth involved in resistance movements in Honduras coincided with the release of a UN report on homicide that finds the Central American nation has one of the world's highest murder rates. Tim Russo reports.
The first Honduran Youth Assembly closed yesterday. The meeting of youth in the resistance movement ended with a declaration of organization against the, quote, politics of death imposed by the Porfirio Lobo government. 33 youth organizations participated in the 4-day event held on the tiny island of Zacate Grande. 2 members of the organizing committee were attacked when their car was fired on as they arrived to the event. The island is home to Honduras's wealthiest landowner, Miguel Facuse, who is embroiled in a long-running land conflict with the island's original inhabitants. The Honduran Youth Assembly coincided with last Friday's release of the first United Nations Global Report on Homicide. The report reveals that Honduras has an astonishing death rate of 82 murders per 100,000 people, compared to only 6.9 globally and 4.6 in the U.S. According to the UN, 1 in 50 males in Honduras aged 20 will be killed before they reach the age of 31. Tim Russo, FSRN, Mexico City.
Sri Lanka's ruling party swept local polls this weekend amid internal party violence that killed three people. Punia Manikavasagam reports.
A prominent politician and advisor to the President Rajapaksa was killed in a shootout between the two factions of the ruling coalition on Saturday. Another legislator, badly injured with bullets in his head, is recovering. The president's party won 22 out of 23 local councils in the third phase of elections. But it failed to capture the municipal council in the nation's capital, Colombo. A government spokesman described the sweeping victory as a vote of confidence for the president. But the Asian Human Rights Commission issued a statement saying that the violence and deaths are signs of brutal and deadly nature of Sri Lankan democracy. The group also said that the government has done away with the legal bodies capable of guaranteeing free and fair elections, all but abolished the constitutional amendment required them. Punya Manikavasagam, FSRN, Sri Lanka.
For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at fsrn.org. I'm Nina Kurigia.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. And these are your local headlines. BC...
You go ahead, CJ.
All right, thank you. The BC Teachers Federation is going to court Tuesday in a gamble that it will gain more legal weight to throw behind slow-moving negotiations in the ongoing strike at BC schools. The 40,000-member Teachers Federation will ask BC Supreme Court Justice Suzanne Griffin to clarify what she meant in April when she ruled the Liberal government violated the union's constitutional rights to negotiate their workplace conditions, including staffing, class size, and composition limits. Teachers Federation President Suzanne Lambert said the court declared the laws unconstitutional and restored the union's right to bargain the class size and composition issues without the specter of restrictive legislation hanging over the talks. But Education Minister George Abbott said the laws remain on the books as the two sides take the court's direction and attempt to resolve the class size and composition issues. The government decided to launch a process to negotiate class composition issues with teachers. Last week, the government offered to spend $165 million over 3 years to address class composition issues to offer more help for students with special needs. The BC Teachers Foundation rejected the offer, calling it inadequate in the face of class size and composition cuts estimated at $336 million annually.
A body has been found at the Vancouver house of West 23rd Avenue. It burned down early Sunday morning, officials said. The victim has not been identified, Vancouver fire officials said Monday. The body was found after rescuers scoured the remains of the house after the second alarm fire tore through the home early Sunday morning. Officials added they will know more when the coroner arrives for an investigation later today. The cause of the fire remains undetermined.
A mild 4.2 earthquake struck off the coast of North Vancouver Island late Sunday, 1 month after a 6.4 quake took place in BC waters further south along the coast. There are no reports of injuries or damage. According to the U.S. Geological Survey's earthquake tracker, the quake struck 158 kilometers west of Port Hardy at 10:39 p.m. last night at a depth of 30.8 kilometers. The quake epicenter is 492 kilometers from Vancouver, directly south of Haida Gwaii.
On Thursday, City Council unanimously approved the creation of Little Saigon. Constable Carrie Jones said that Little Saigon District, which will be designated along Kingsway between Nanaimo and Fraser Streets, will help celebrate and promote Vietnamese culture. The Vietnamese community represents 30,000 residents and makes up Vancouver's fifth largest ethnic group. Little Saigon is about helping brand the business district to attract new businesses and to really motivate the current owners to fix up businesses. there because it's a little run down in the area, Jang says. Quote, this brings a sense of community pride and investment, end quote. Members of the Vietnamese community approached council 2 years ago with a Little Saigon proposal to formalize the area into a district where their culture is celebrated with banners and signs similar to Chinatown. A community-led referendum showed that more than 90% support for the Vietnamese and non-Vietnamese businesses in the Kingsway area. According to Jang, consultations with area residents, business merchants, community members, and groups will begin to determine the boundaries where people would see bilingual signs and banners. The community is starting to raise money for the signs and banners, Jang added, and they're rearing to revitalize the area. Vietnamese Canadians released a statement Thursday thanking the city for respecting and recognizing their contributions.
The federal government is considering its options for handling a threat by Air Canada flight attendants to walk off the job as early as Thursday. A statement issued by Labour Minister Lisa Raitt's office leaves little doubt the government will intervene if the flight attendants go on strike. The statement says the government considers the work stoppage unacceptable in this time of a fragile economy. The 6,800 flight attendants have rejected a tentative deal reached between their union and the airline and are poised to go on strike at 12:01 a.m. on Thursday, the union said in a news release this Sunday. The Canadian Union of Public Employees said 65% of the flight attendants who cast ballots voted to reject management proposals. It was the second time in recent months that flight attendants have turned down a tentative agreement with the airline. They voted 87% against ratifying the previous effort in August. Customers who have already bought tickets to fly over the next 6 days will be allowed to change their travel dates at no charge, the airline said.
This Sunday, Sinopec International Petroleum agreed to pay $2.2 billion for Calgary-based conventional oil and gas producer Daylight Energy Limited. This is part of the aggressive push by China's state-backed energy companies into Canada. Daylight Chief Executive Anthony Lambert said that the all-cash offer for Daylight recognizes the highly attractive asset portfolio that has been established in Alberta and Northeast British Columbia. Most of the Chinese energy investment in Canada since 2009 has focused on oil sand projects, but the recent emergence of liquefied natural gas from North America has potential new fuel source for the energy-hungry Chinese economy, has prompted interest in conventional oil and gas producers. Daylight produced 140 million cubic feet of natural gas and 13,400 barrels of high-value light oil and natural gas liquids a day in the second quarter of 2011. Sinopec is China's largest producer and supplier of oil products and petrochemicals. The acquisition of Daylight gives it direct operational control of mid-sized company that is involved in technically challenging development of shale gas in the prolific basins of Northeast British Columbia. Daylight says that two-thirds of its shareholders, as well as the Canadian courts and regulators, must still approve the offer.
City Councillor Ellen Wordsworth of the Coalition of Progressive Electors, or COPE, and COPE candidate for the park board Brent Granby are supporting the creation of a permanent farmers market infrastructure that would operate throughout the entire year. While farmers markets are becoming an ever-popular occurrence in Vancouver neighborhoods, they are still mostly limited to the fair-weather spring and summer months. Brent Granby said that we need to think of the bigger picture and how much an amenity such as this would benefit our city, and also stating that in just over 10 years, Vancouver's farmers markets went from one location, a weekly community gathering running from May to October, to a five-location economic powerhouse, pumping $10 million into the local economy last year, including $4.1 million in direct sales. COPE is supporting the creation of the New City Market, a project that, thanks to a 100,000 Van City grant, has made it to the business planning stage. The New City Market, the brainchild of Vancouver nonprofit Local Food First, would serve three main functions. First, as a permanent market and storage space for local producers. Second, as an education and community outreach resource, as well as a value-added food processing location. Co-op looks forward to seeing the business plan and financial assessment and plans on making its completion a priority for City Council.
Those are your local headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
Hello, hello, hello! My name is Tim, and every Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m. I will be playing best punk, hardcore, metal, ska, and reggae music for you from all over the world. We All Fall Down on 101.9 FM CITR in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Most shocking monster.
That techno rock you guys listen to is gutless.
I'm sure.
And the only reason you don't understand our music is that you don't like it.
After I'm gone, your Earth will be free to live out its miserable span of existence.
Can anyone stop their mechanical mayhem?
All of my most sensitive areas were inflamed. My extremities pulsating with tingling sensation.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology.
Swaying back and forth. A beautiful thing taking me away.
You are a robot.
You must listen to Synaptic Sandwich. Saturday night from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. on CITR FM 101.9.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Nina Kurgia.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Thank you for being with us. It's now time for the international news. Prices for rice, wheat, and other key foods are expected to remain volatile and possibly increase, the United Nations Food Agency said on Monday. In an annual report on the state of food insecurity around the world, the UN's three food agencies urged governments to make good on pledges to share information about farm forecasts and food stock levels to avoid the price swings that resulted in food riots in 2006 and 2008, as well as an 8% increase in the number of undernourished people in Africa. They also urged greater long-term investment in the agricultural sectors of poor countries so that farmers can bolster production to meet increasing demand and cope better when food crises hit. The agencies warned that failure to do so will result in continued price fluctuations, which makes poor farmers and consumers in food importing countries at ever greater risk for poverty in both the short and long term, it said. The report also stated that, quote, changes in income due to price swings that lead to decreased food consumption can reduce children's intake of key nutrient nutrients during the first 1,000 days of life from conception, leading to a permanent reduction of their future earning capacity and an increased likelihood of future poverty with negative effects on their entire economy. The report was produced by the Rome-based UN Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Food Programme, and for the first time, the United Nations International Fund for Agriculture Development.
The entire police force of the northern Mexican city of Linares is being held for the investigation of possible corruption and ties to organized crime. Mexican soldiers and Nuevo León state police are patrolling instead. The detention of more than 100 officers comes after a rise in kidnapping and extortion in the area. A series of investigations in other towns already has put hundreds of officers in custody. Linares Mayor Francisco Medina Quintanilla told Millennium Television on Sunday that his city's police officers were put on buses and driven to another town. They will be held there by state investigators while they are investigated. Linares is about 75 miles or 120 kilometers southeast of the northern industrial city of Monterrey. Thai authorities are building sandbag barricades in the capital, Bangkok, to protect it from the worst floods that Thailand has seen or faced in 5 decades. Thailand's Disaster Prevention and Mitigation Department says that 269 people have died, mostly from drowning, since tropical storms began hitting Thailand at the end of July. It says 8.2 million people in 60 of the country's 77 provinces have been affected by floods and mudslides, and 30 provinces are currently inundated. Reuters reported that although the capital has only seen minor flooding in the past week, officials fear that conditions will worsen after October 13th. High spring tides are expected to block water from Cao Prava River from flowing into the sea, potentially causing massive flooding in the Thai capital. The Thai Prime Minister said on Monday that government workers have 2 days to build 3 major water barricades to prevent flooding in Bangkok before runoff from the north reaches the capital. Although Thailand has been hit by floods in the past, analysts argue this time the damages might be more severe. Thailand's finance minister said the country's central bank estimates that the flood damage could reach $2 billion.
Libya's interim government forces say that they have pro-Gaddafi forces cornered in 2 small areas of Sirte. One commander told Reuters that they had backed the loyalists into about 2 square kilometers of land near the sea. But heavy fighting continues in Sirte, the hometown of fugitive former leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, as the loyalists put up fierce resistance. National Transitional Council fighters launched what they have called the final assault on Sirte on Friday. Dozens of anti-Gaddafi force troops have been arriving from across Libya to join the battle. But they have been surprised by the level of resistance from an enemy that has rejected an offer to surrender and has vowed to fight to the bitter end. NTC forces suffered heavy losses on Sunday, and they had to call for reinforcements in the desert enclave of Bani Walid, another Gaddafi stronghold, after losing 17 fighters. NTC chiefs admit the battles have been vicious, but say they are still optimistic they will liberate both Sirte and Bani Walid this week. The NTC says that once Sirte falls, they will declare national liberation.
Those are your international headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
Walking alone at night can be scary!
Stop right there, student. Why walk alone when you can call Safe Walk? The safety and comfort of everyone on campus is important. That's why we're here.
SafeWalk is a free, student-run foot patrol service with 2-person co-ed teams that will meet you and accompany you anywhere on campus to make sure you get there safely.
Keep an eye out for our bright red reflective jackets and signature foot logo, and let your next walk be with us.
What a huge relief! Now I'll never have to worry about the terrors that could happen when walking through such a big campus at night.
for a walk, you can call 604-822-5355. Use one of our direct line phones located in some of the campus libraries. Use one of the big blue phone booths. Or even ask campus security to contact us.
If you see walkers around campus and you'd like them to accompany you, stop and ask.
I'm troubled by shapeless fears. Who can live in the modern world without catching his share of them? I hope I've landed on my feet this time.
Need a place to rent? Have a place for rent? AMS Rentsline can help. AMS Rentsline is an easy-to-operate, touch-tone, and web-based system that connects thousands of landlords with UBC students looking for off-campus housing. UBC students can search the ads for free or place a two-week posting for $5. To view current listings, visit www.amsrentsline.com.
Welcome back to News 101 here at CITR 101.9, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at Vancouver, British Columbia, at UBC Vancouver, British Columbia. In our next segment, I'd like to talk about the Occupy Wall Street movements, as well as the Occupy movement spreading across America and across the world. Sitting in front of me now is John Hayes, a member of the Occupy Vancouver movement that will be taking place on October 15th in downtown Vancouver. So, John, go ahead and tell us a bit about it.
All right. Well, I'll begin by reading out an umbrella statement that was written by one of my partners in the media commission as part of Occupy Vancouver. So thanks to him for writing this. This is an umbrella statement that we know will evolve as Occupy Vancouver grows and flourishes. Our demands and our dreams are not limited to this statement, as we have many ideas and solutions. However, this statement represents a basic starting point and a common basis of unity for those who gathered at the General Assembly and who plan on gathering on October 15th at 10 a.m. at the Vancouver Art Gallery. 1. We acknowledge that Occupy Vancouver is taking place on unceded Coast Salish territories. 2. We come together across our diverse experiences to find creative ways to transform the unequal, unfair, and growing disparity in the distribution of power and wealth in our city and around the globe. We come together to challenge the corporatism and corporate greed, systemic inequality, militarization, environmental destruction, erosion of civil liberties and democratic rights, and the general lack of access to basic human needs, including water, healthcare, education, childcare, shelter, and food in Vancouver and across the globe. We seek economic security, genuine equality, and the protection of the environment for all. 3. We are inspired and in solidarity with global movements, including those across the Middle East, Europe, and the Occupy Wall Street / Occupy Together movement in over 1,000 cities in North America and spreading throughout the world. 4. We are committed to an inclusive and welcoming space, to addressing issues of oppression and discrimination, and to creating an environment where all the 99% can be heard and can meaningfully participate. We are also committed to safeguarding our collective well-being, including safety from interpersonal violence and any potential police violence.
Thank you, John. That was great. I mean, it's definitely clear from what you read and from what I've been seeing online and what I've been reading online that there's definitely global support for the people at Wall Street right now. I mean, if you look at some of those Google Docs that Occupy Together has been creating, you can see more than 130, 140 groups cropping up around the world. I mean, from Queensland to Ireland. I mean, even places in like Pakistan and the Middle East, you know. So it's clear that these problems are not limited to one financial sector in biggest city in the world. These are problems that have developed over the years, and not even 2008, but over the years from like Reagan or things like the Bush era, you know. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's great to see this sort of support crop up. And I mean, tell us a little bit about how you guys would like to use things like social media to spread awareness about this.
Well, firstly, I can only speak on behalf of myself.
Absolutely.
I can't speak on behalf of Occupy Vancouver, mostly because it's a collective movement and it's in its very early steps, and nothing has really been decided upon, and I think most of that will happen on Saturday. So it's really hard to tell what the guiding vision will be for it.
Okay, so Saturday, but tell me how long this has been going on for. I mean, did you guys meet up last week or 2 weeks ago? Or
2 weeks ago, I actually was from following Occupy Wall Street, and then I saw I had friends on the East Coast in Boston, for example, who were starting to organize in Occupy Boston. So I got curious, and I Googled Occupy Vancouver, and nothing came up. Mm-hmm. And then 2 days later, my friend sent me a link on Facebook to the newly formed Facebook group for Occupy Vancouver. And so in less than 2 weeks, it's gone from non-existence to becoming what potentially is going to be like a very big occupation and hopefully one of the biggest ones in North America right now.
I was just going to ask, did you guys, when you got the group together, how did you... Did you actually physically get together and talk about, because I know you just read out the 10, or what was it that you had just...
The umbrella statement.
The umbrella statement. Yeah, did you guys think of that together, like coming together, or...
Well, this all came, I think, from just a small group of organizers, and they called for a general assembly to happen last Saturday. So I basically just showed up. And we had a general assembly, discussed kind of the identity of the movement, what we want to do collectively, what we don't want to do, and basically after that, we broke into what became different commissions to organize all the fine details of what it takes to have this be successful.
Including security, including legal, including where people will sleep.
We have organizing committees that are organizing kid zones and childcare for people that will have to bring their children. A food zone so that everyone doing the occupation can be fed. The BC Civil Liberties Association came to tell us a few general rules about like what our rights are and what the police are legally allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do to protesters. There's also a finance committee. They just opened a Van City account for accepting donations to the movement. There's a live stream that will be happening as part of the media committee, as well as the Vancouver Media Co-op will have a tent. Yes, and then as you mentioned, security, which will also be looking after first aid. There'll be some medics. And then there's a committee for figuring out the infrastructure. So getting a hold of permits and securing the location. And there's a committee to coordinate with Vancouver's homeless population, because the General Assembly decided that it would be a good idea and a very important thing to do.
Absolutely, because ultimately, there are people who will be affected by this as well, not only because we will be occupying the place where they sort of sleep at night, but also because They're the result of what's been happening over the years. I mean, the financial result, right?
I'm really curious. We already talked about this, but when you came to the meeting, what kind of people, like, was it young people, old people, how many people, what type of people were at this meeting did you find, in your opinion?
I was actually quite surprised by the diversity of people, especially generationally. I was expecting it to look kind of like the early days of Occupy Wall Street when it was a lot of young white radicals.
Yeah, that's what I would think, yeah.
But then you go there, and of course there's that demographic. There's like a lot of students, like me. But then there were folks that were like 70 years old.
Wow.
There were parents there with their babies, with their kids of all ages. So yeah, it's quite a tremendous diversity.
And would you say like it was people who have, you know, high paying jobs, low paying, like what kind of demographic was that? Do you think it was mostly just people like, you know, like union workers?
I get what you mean. For example, in the Wall Street protest, there were definitely people in suits who were showing up. I mean, I saw videos of people who would say they were bankers or say they were Republicans would still show up because they felt this was something that they had to support.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think that would be something we would see in Vancouver? Like,
it's hard to say right now.
True.
Like I said earlier, it's all up in the air until Saturday comes, and then we'll see.
Absolutely. So tell me a bit about, thinking of the number of people that have been arrested in New York. I mean, we don't want to cause a panic, but it would be a great idea if this cause was not sidetracked by arrests. You know how the media works. I mean, it works. It looks at an arrest as something that boosts a protest, which is not what we want to.
But it seems you guys are really organized about this. You already have that kind of down pack. You know what your rights are. You know why officers can arrest you, and you guys even have a plan of where you are going to be going. So
yeah, but it's still very, very early, and a lot of tactical issues have not been addressed by everybody, because right now the main concern is addressing what everybody's there for and what people want to do. And so one thing, this is just speaking for myself, that has not been addressed is dealing with protesters that decide that one of the tactics they want to follow is property damage.
Yeah.
True. Yeah.
Personally, I oppose property damage, because if you start smashing bank windows, that's what makes the news.
Yeah.
You know, so that's just me.
Absolutely. I agree with you. I mean, it takes away from the message, you know, that you're trying to spend.
And there's no control over the amount of people who will get there who want to do those types of things. So it's hard to say what's going to happen.
True. It is true that protests like this might attract people like them, but it is also true that it's your responsibility as an organized group to make sure the stuff like this doesn't happen.
Yeah, I think for the longevity of this movement, I think peaceful, dignified protest is the best way. And I think Occupy Wall Street is a testament to that. Because they have not engaged in property damage or like violent confrontation, it's been able to grow.
Yeah.
True. So, speaking of the longevity, do you have any sort of inclination as to how long people will decide to stay there, or how long are you planning to stay there?
It's a mystery. I mean, it's definitely going to be indefinite. It really I think it depends on how the protest goes, and it depends on the police response. I think the city, in conjunction with the VPD, will have an easier time justifying a crackdown against violent protest because of the riots and because of the fact that we're in the Pacific Northwest. In 1999, there was the Battle of Seattle.
True.
And I think that's had ripple effects into Vancouver as well. And they're very aware that they're might potentially be groups that use tactics such as property damage. So if that happens, I think the cops will crack down. And if that happens, I think it'll compromise the longevity.
Question, do you guys, I'm just wondering about this in terms of demonstrations like this in general, do you guys have contact with the police, or do they just find out about it in their own way and come when they know what's going to happen?
Well, the police definitely know that Occupy Vancouver is happening. Yeah. And from what I've heard, they do not plan on being confrontational so long as the protesters are not confrontational with them.
Okay, so you guys don't directly speak with them and you know, tell them your plan? It's not like a work together type of thing, or?
I'm not sure what some of the organizers are doing. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that there has been contact between organizers and the police.
Okay.
So I'm really glad you mentioned the Seattle protests, because there was this video on Democracy Now! Where they were interviewing Naomi Klein, who's an award-winning journalist, and so she was talking about the idea of the message behind these protests. And of course, as most of us here know, that the problem has become so complex that the ability to make the message one single soundbite is absolutely impossible, right?
Yeah.
So I just thought we could watch this video for a second and see how we react to it, you know?
Wasn't that to be something else, right? I mean, let's not get hung up on it. During the anti-corporate protests that began, you know, came to world attention in Seattle in 1999, it was, what's your alternative? Because our demand was really clear. We wanted to shut down the WTO. We wanted, you know, we wanted to shut down the IMF. Our demands were very clear. So it was, you know, well, what do you want instead? And there's always going to be one of these memes out there that is just really about delegitimizing dissent, and we shouldn't get hung up on it. And I think it's good that you know, Nick Kristof wrote this absurd column telling the protesters what their demands should be. And they are these extremely sort of wonky, you know, good ideas about how to reform the financial sector. But the problem is that I think they're too small. And you don't know how big you can dream until you know how big your movement is. And so that's why I think the Chilean students, you know, they've got a big demand. And that demand has been enormously...
Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. Let's listen to that once again.
That
just so
my
that
favorite.
John
I
gets
I took
to
a picture
hear
of that on my phone. This line, you know, what's your demand? What's your message? If it wasn't that, it'd be something else. Right. I mean, let's not get hung up on it. During the anti-corporate protests that began, you know, came to world attention in Seattle in 1999, it was, what's your alternative? Because our demand was really clear. We wanted to shut down the WTO. We wanted to shut down the IMF. Our demands were very clear. So it was, well, what do you want instead? And there's always going to be one of these memes out there that is just really about delegitimizing dissent, and we shouldn't get hung up on it. And I think it's good that you know, Nick Kristof wrote this absurd column telling the protesters what their demands should be. And they are these extremely sort of wonky, you know, good ideas about how to reform the financial sector. But the problem is that I think they're too small. And you don't know how big you can dream until you know how big your movement is. And so that's why I think the Chilean students, you know, they've got a big demand. And that demand has been enormously galvanizing, one big clear demand for a movement like this that is really going after a system. You know, this is the people who've learned the lesson of pinning all their hopes on the Democratic Party, thinking that they could just change the person in power and that would fix things. So now they're going after a system, and what the demands should be to affect a system this pervasive and complex are by no means clear. We don't know what it is. So it's really about the courage to ask questions which we don't have the available answers for, which is something that Wes Jackson, a wonderful, wonderful poet of farming who runs the Land Institute in Kansas, says that we have to have the courage to ask questions for which we don't have the available answers. And that's what that wonderful open space in at Liberty Plaza represents to me, that people are asking those questions and give themselves the space to dream big.
Well, so listening to that little soundbite by Naomi Klein, I think we can all agree that she's right in saying that First, of course, that the message is too big to be simplified. And second, that the system's too messed up to simplify into a message. But, I mean, speaking in terms of the Canadian political environment, what do you think Occupy Vancouver has to say about Canadian politics? I mean, is there something wrong that we'd like to address within our system as well, do you think? Is that something you've talked about in your General Assembly, maybe?
Last Saturday, that was not discussed. I think she's very correct in saying that there are so many different people out there and so many different groups with so many different agendas that it's very, very difficult to pin down, you know, a list of demands. That umbrella statement that I read out earlier is just very, very general things that within the General Assembly we all agreed upon.
True.
And came to consensus. So a lot of it, I think, connects to socioeconomic factors in the United States that resonate here as well. But there are definite specific, like Vancouver-specific issues.
Like what you said, one of them was about the land that it's being... it's going to happen on belongs to
the native.
Yes. The first acknowledgement of Occupy Vancouver is that it's taking place on unceded Coast Salish territories. So that right there is a very Vancouver specific example.
True. And it's definitely very respectful to those people as well.
Yeah. And I think the first thing I thought when you said that was like, I don't think I ever hear people acknowledging Native Americans here, like, I mean, that just is very interesting, and it's nice to hear. And I think that with that, you can get a specific demographic of Native Americans coming out, or and say First Nations coming out and saying wanting to be there as well, because they're realizing that they're being acknowledged in something, as opposed to how they're never acknowledged in anything that happens.
Mm-hmm.
So that was interesting.
Yeah. And as she discussed, I think people are becoming disillusioned with the idea of changing things from within. You know, like she said, that you can just put one vote out, or you think you can change the person in office and that'll change everything, you know.
Yeah, it's clear that it has failed so far.
Yeah, the 2008 presidential campaign was a testament to that as a failure. You know, the Hope campaign didn't pan out.
True, I mean... Either Obama wasn't man enough to face the Republican Party, or...
Well, I mean, I think it also... You can't put the blame on anyone, because it's one person can't make a difference in an entire system
that's true.
Generalizing it too much. I mean, there's so many things that maybe a president would want to do, but it is impossible for them to do that because there's restrictions. There's thousands of people involved in making those decisions, right? And it depends on so many different factors. It's not just saying, okay, well, these people want to change this, so let's change it, because as soon as you change something, it affects someone else. It's hard to make those big changes, but at least what these protests are doing is a starting point.
Yeah, addressing those factors that are limiting the system at the very least, you know.
Yeah. And with Occupy Vancouver, I mean, the main criticism is, and this is, I've had this, like, reiterated to me over and over again from friends just in, like, casual conversation, that there's no unifying vision for the movement as being kind of, like, the downfall of it. But I don't think it's really in anybody's interest to have, like, a perfectly, like, panned out, detailed set of demands so early.
Yeah.
Because if anything, that would kind of, like, jeopardize the continuity of it.
Mm-hmm.
As well as if you're trying to get more and more people involved, especially people from the mainstream or people that are kind of on the fence about if they should join up or not, you don't want to turn people off.
Yeah, simply by unifying your message. Yeah. By having a variety of messages, you can make sure that people who suffer those problems as well can join you.
Mm-hmm. So when you see groups that go all the way from unions to church groups, it's pretty apparent that there's going to be a wide range of perspectives on what this movement means.
But it is, like, thinking about that, it is kind of a, like, scary thought, because it's like all of a sudden there's going to be so many different people wanting so many things, like, their own, that all of a sudden it goes from, like, being, it is a big problem to even a bigger problem, because it's like all of a sudden everybody wants something out of it. So how do you put it all into...
So you're saying who should be addressed first, for example?
Well, yeah, who should be addressed first? And also, once there's so many people asking for stuff, that just makes it even more complicated to begin with. And then all of a sudden you have a big problem, and then it's like, whoa, now we have to actually try and fix it.
That's true. Is that something you've been talking about, the General Assembly? I mean, is there a legal team, for example, that's handling the discussions with political parties who are ultimately responsible for making these changes?
I don't think there is.
No?
No, I think at this point there has not been any direct engagement with actual political parties.
But, I mean, I think that's gradual, too, like of what course, you were saying. Yeah. At first, everyone needs to hear what you have to say and see whether they agree, and then you can start bringing in people.
And you're gonna hear everything. You're going to hear everything from 9/11 was an inside job to... let's destroy capitalism to let's make a more just and inclusive form of capitalism. So you're going to hear everything from this movement. And you've been hearing everything from all the other cities that have been...
Absolutely, from the extreme to the rational.
And I think with Vancouver too, which is a very, like, you know, nature-driven society of people who like their nature, I think there's going to be a lot of environmental issues brought up too, probably because that's what capitalism has been... doing. It's been not helping the environment very much.
Yeah, I mean, Vancouver as a modern city grew out of logging and mining. That's how the city became a big, large city. So I'm sure that will be addressed as well.
All right. That was John Hayes, a member of the Occupy Vancouver demonstration set to take place on Saturday, October 15th. In downtown Vancouver. If you are listening to this, you're more than welcome. Right, John?
Yes.
Absolutely. And I'm pretty sure CITR News, News 101, will be there.
Definitely.
Reporting, excellent.
Probably reporting live.
Yeah.
We could do one of these phone interviews for the first time.
Yeah,
and
we'll be...
make sure the message is spread not only across Vancouver, but across the internet.
And don't forget, if you have any comments or questions, send us an email, news@citr.ca. We would love to hear them. We'd love to hear what your individual problems are, individual problems that you've heard. Just let us know.
That's our program for October 10th, 2011. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us a hot news tip, please contact us at any time. Our phone number is 604-822-5334. Or you can email us anytime at news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITR News. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news on News 101, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Nina Krigia. Today's show was produced by myself and CJ, with a very special thanks to John. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening.